The next case is 06-12-12, Melissa Arbino versus Johnson and Johnson. Ms. Aberay.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Janet Aberay. I'm with the law firm of Berg, Simpson, Eldridge, Hirsch, and Jardine in Cincinnati. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please, which will be presented by my colleague, Mr. Robert Peck. We're here today on behalf of the plaintiff petitioner, Melissa Arbino, who suffered serious and permanent injury from her use of the OrthoEver birth control patch manufactured by the defendant, Johnson & Johnson. Ms. Arbino suffered blood clots at the age of 24. Her first clots appeared in her brain. Basically, she suffered a stroke. She had to be rushed to the hospital. The doctors had to drill holes in her skull to relieve the pressure from the buildup of the blood and fluid in her brain. She was hospitalized for a week, placed on blood thinners, and then discharged. 4 days later, Ms. Arbino was back in the hospital, this time with blood clots throughout her lungs. This condition, too, could have proven fatal. Luckily, it did not. She was hospitalized another week, discharged again on blood thinners, and the blood thinners were of the type that she had to inject herself in the abdomen with the blood thinners for a month or so, and then was put on Coumadin. She was on long-term anticoagulation therapy. She's now considered to be high risk for pregnancy. If she chooses to have a child, she will have to go back on the Lovenox, which is the blood thinner that she has to inject into her abdomen twice a day. And of course, both she and her child would be at risk of injury due to blood clots or due to hemorrhaging from the blood thinners. As a result of her injuries, Ms. Arbino also cannot take any hormonal birth control products, and she will not be able to take hormonal products for menopause. The state of Ohio and the legislature has prejudged Ms. Arbino's case. They passed a statute that states that without considering Ms. Arbino as an individual, without looking at what happened to her and considering any evidence, her damages for pain and suffering are to be capped arbitrarily based upon a number selected by the legislature. We challenge that today on a constitutional basis, and specifically based on years and years, and in fact centuries of precedent of this court and the Ohio Constitution, which holds that the right to trial by jury is inviolate. And we would emphasize that when considering a constitutional right, and especially a fundamental right, but when looking at any constitutional challenge, the first question the court must ask is, what is the state interest that is being promoted by this statute? And House and Senate Bill 80 is a very unusual statute compared to the other tort reform statutes this court has considered, because medical malpractice has been separated out of Senate Bill 80 and it's treated by a different statute. So the only thing contained in Senate Bill 80 are civil actions excluding breach of contract and excluding medical malpractice, and it also excludes wrongful death in the caps. The reason that's important, and Justice O'Connor, in your the unanimous opinion that you authored in Norwood versus Herney, if the only state interest is an economic interest, then that does not suffice to take away constitutional rights of citizens of Ohio. And that's what this court held in Norwood versus Horney, that an economic interest alone does not rise to the level of a state interest that permits an imposition on the constitutional rights of Ohio citizens.
I'm sorry, should we examine the language of Section 5 of the Constitution, Article 1, that's used frequently to support an argument that essentially that someone's right to a jury in a civil case is inviolate without sometimes it's argued as if the General Assembly nor the court may place any limitations on that right, which we know is not the case, don't we?
That they may or may not.
Well, judgment notwithstanding the verdict, directed verdict, motion for summary judgment, we do place limits on this inviolate right. It doesn't inviolate, couldn't it be argued that inviolate means that you cannot be denied a right to a jury trial, whatever that is?
No, I don't think it could, Your Honor. And the examples that you set forth of remitter or judgment notwithstanding the verdict, those are remedies that the court employs if the jury has made an error as a matter of law. So if the court determines that the jury acted under passion and prejudice, or that the verdict is not supported by the great weight of the evidence, or if the court looks at the evidence and says, construing all evidence in favor of the non-moving party, there cannot be a judgment for this plaintiff.
Sure, but what is it in the word inviolate that says the General Assembly, when it creates, if it creates a remedy for an alleged wrong, cannot put some limits on the recovery? What in the term inviolate says that, draws us to that conclusion? I guess that's because we know it's not inviolate in the sense that no one can place any limits on one's right to a jury. That would be uncontrollable, obviously. So we put limits on the jury, bases a decision on evidence that's not in the record. Okay, we have a remedy for that, a judicial remedy for that. General Assembly has made a policy decision that says, sure, you can have a right to a jury, but we're going to place certain limits on that right. How is it different in approaching the word inviolate than these other limitations?
Well, Your Honor, inviolate means that it cannot be intruded upon by the legislature or by this court, and that's been the holding of this court in numerous previous decisions, including the 1913 case of Gibbs versus Girard, where this court held that the right of trial by jury, being guaranteed to all of our citizens by the Constitution of the state, cannot be invaded or violated by either legislative act or judicial decree.
The right to a jury. And no question about that, the right to have a jury. But then from there, where do we go? What does that right to a jury include? Does it include a jury doing whatever a panel of my peers in the community wants to decide? Or are there limits on that right to a jury? I think our Constitution was drafted still somewhat in the reflection of the founding of the country, that where there was clearly a strong, strong desire to get the king out of determining people's rights in courts. And so this inviolate right to a jury says you can't interfere with that. You can't tell me I can't have a jury because I have a certain kind of case, or I mean we have limits on that, as you know, but I guess this word inviolate to me is a bit of a, it hasn't been. The previous cases in this court have just said it's inviolate, and so it means, you know, we strike down these encroachments. But it's never really been, I think, examined in a way that it should be examined in this case. Because here we have, as you rightly recognize, General Assembly's carved out one area for these limits, and so I think we have to really.
Well, Your Honor, if I could respond.
Sure.
First of all, an inviolate right to the jury means that the jury will determine the amount of compensatory damages, and that has been consistently held by this court. Now, is a jury permitted to do something illegal or in violation of the evidence? No. There are checks that the court will impose if the jury is persuaded by passion and prejudice. But the fundamental right to trial by jury includes the right for the individual to be fully compensated and made whole. And what the legislature is saying is, we're going to take that right for you to be made whole, and we're going to prejudge your case.
And punitive damages don't make that person
now,
whole.
Now, punitive damages, Your Honor.
To take away from your argument, that's an exception, I would think, to your statement.
Well, I think what your question is there is, are there due process limits upon the rights to damages? Yeah. And the Supreme Court case law has set forth some criteria where they're now making a distinction between compensatory and punitive damages, the United States Supreme Court, and stating that compensatory damages are a finding of fact, which therefore must be, under the Seventh Amendment, protected. and there cannot be any imposition upon the right of the jury to determine compensatory damages, but then they're treating punitive damages as a different development, more penal in nature, and therefore not really a finding of fact. Those damages are limited by due process, and this court has followed the Supreme Court authority in the Dardinger case that, yes, there are due process limits on punitive damages. The problem with this statute, Your Honor, is that they've attempted, the legislature has attempted to codify the punitive damages case law from the United States Supreme Court, but what they've done is to completely get it wrong. Instead of having punitive damages be related to the reprehensibility of the conduct of the defendant, they instead are relating punitive damages to the size of the defendant and how many employees it has. They're also stating that punitive damages will depend upon whether someone else got an award of punitive damages that will be used as a set-off. And that, Your Honor, is directly contradictory to the logic and the holding of the most recent Supreme Court case, which is Philip Morris versus Williams. And in that case, Your Honor, the court held that punitive damages have to be based upon the harm to the plaintiff in the courtroom. Not to other parties, not to other people. The punitive damage level has to be based on the harm to the individual plaintiff. So what the legislature has proposed is a procedure where there's a set-off because the defendant paid punitive damages to someone else, which should have absolutely nothing to do with the punitive damages awarded in the plaintiff's case under Phillips versus Williams.
May I ask you?
Excuse me.
I'm interested in your views on what weight we should give to the Sheward case in considering the issues raised here, which are similar to what the court's ruled on.
Well, Your Honor, Sheward obviously is the opinion of this court on the last go-round of tort reform. But the important part about Sheward is it's based upon prior precedent, which has been incorporated into the holding on Sheward. So for example, in Sheward, the holding about punitive damages is based upon the prior holding in Zopo that the Ohio Constitution recognizes a right to jury trial on punitive damages. The decisions about the arbitrary nature of the caps are based upon the holding in Morris versus Savoy, that you can't just arbitrarily pick one group of plaintiffs and say, okay, people with small claims get paid in full, people in the exception get paid in full, people in the middle don't get paid. And if you look throughout all the holdings in Sheward, some we aren't arguing here, such as the statute of repose, but again, Sheward is based upon applying longstanding precedent of this court back to the 1800s when this court held in Roberts versus Mason that there's a constitutional right to trial by jury.
But the essential ruling of Sheward was log rolling. That was the basis of it. The rest was essentially dicta because the legal holding, and you know I wrote an extensive dissent on the log rolling issue, not the other issues, and that's not in this case at all.
Well, that's why I was saying that if you look at the analysis of Sheward, it's actually incorporating all these prior holdings of the court. And so if this court were to try to determine that there's no constitutional right to have the jury determine the amount of compensatory damages, the court would have to overrule Zopo, Galeda, Sorrell, Cleveland versus Halliday, Neasley versus Latimer Smith, Gibbs versus Girard, and Chester Park versus Schulte. And that's just a small list. Those cases go back to the 1800s.
Can you explain to me exactly why you claim you no longer have standing on the third issue, collateral source?
Yes, Your Honor. Our discovery has indicated that Ms. Arbino's insurance policy does have a subrogation right in it, and there's an exception in Senate Bill 80 that there's no introduction of collateral source evidence if there's a subrogation right. Your Honors, I see that my time has run. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abreu. Ms. Walker. Ms. Keyes-Walker, excuse me.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name's Irene Keyes-Walker. I'll be arguing on behalf of both of the respondents in this case. To answer the three certified questions before this court must first delineate the constitutional limits on the duty of the legislature as well as the courts to modify and adapt our common law system to the evolving needs of society. And second, decide whether, on their face, three statutes passed in 2005 violate those limits. Because that's the issue, I'm not going to address the facts in this case, which at this point are mere allegations, no discovery's been taken, and they're not relevant to a facial challenge on the Constitution. But what I do want to address first off is Justice Moyer's question, what does inviolate mean? Justice Asher Sweeney actually answered that question in his partial dissent in Morris versus Savoy. He looked to Black's Legal Dictionary, and the answer was free from substantial restriction. Substantial. Similarly, the right to a remedy by this court has repeatedly been defined as a meaningful remedy at a meaningful time. These are words of flexibility, not undue rigidity, not...
Petitioner argues, as you know, that the limits placed on the rather modest limits placed on the General Assembly on the pain and suffering in particular really affect the recovery of those who were injured the most or most egregiously injured, I guess you might say. What's your response to that?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, there is no cap on so-called catastrophic damages, right. None at all. Non-economic damages are not capped for those serious physical deformities or physical loss of function.
But there are a number of cases, I would guess, in which that don't fit into that sort of narrow category that the General Assembly accepted, aren't there? This sounds like it may be one of them.
Well, Your Honor, if that's true, quite frankly, in the first place, that would be an as-applied challenge. Whether or not after all of the facts in this case are developed, whether the court erred in its decision, legal decision, which category this particular injury fell in. This case looks to whether under any conceivable facts, restrictions of compensatory damages and punitive damages, some compensatory damages, non-economic damages, and non-catastrophic injury can be limited. And the idea that damage awards are somehow sacrosanct from all legislative and judicial review or change is simply not true. The best example I can give this court.
Well, counsel, you've made a nice argument in your brief and here that all of this is subject to change, but that is really, the problem is the Constitution. That's not subject to change. And there are two or three straightforward mandates in the Constitution, right to trial by jury inviolate, right to remedy for damages done. Those seem to be certain and inflexible. Everybody skips across Morris versus Savoy. Justice Wright, writing for I believe Justice Holmes was the only dissenter, found that caps violated due process. He didn't even get into the right to remedy or the inviolate right to a jury, but just to, on a due process ground. So how has that changed?
Well, now I have three answers for you, Your Honor. First, I would say Morris versus Savoy, it was due process and found no rational relationship, between the remedy or the legislation and the intent of the legislature or the purpose of the legislation, which was
In his last sentence, he says, we therefore hold 230743 is unconstitutional because it does not bear a real or substantial relation to public health or welfare, and further because it is unreasonable and arbitrary.
Period. Yes, Your Honor. And that, of course, did include catastrophic injuries, something we have here, wrongful death, something that's been carved out here. It had its own provisions. It had different reasoning of the legislature to reduce medical malpractice premiums, and the court specifically found that because some of the tort reforms that it had been issued did not have to be studied to determine whether or not it actually
would it be over. Fair to say there are no cases from this court finding caps on damages to be constitutional, and there are a number finding them not to be constitutionally
Your Honor, within the last 2 years, this court has held that in certain medical malpractice cases, non-economic damages are not even available, much less caps on those non-economic damages. And that was this court's decision in Shermer versus Mount Auburn. This court said that negligent Genetic counseling is a species of medical malpractice, but there would be a limited damage rule applied.
That was a tort that has not been recognized in this state.
Medical malpractice has certainly been recognized in this state, Your Honor, since the time of the Constitution. And this court held that it was a species of medical malpractice. And that's exactly the kind of constitutional flexibility this court needs with the common law, as well as the legislature, to be able to say we're going to expand our definition of medical malpractice. We're going to include additional compensatory damages, such as hedonic damages.
I want to take you for a moment to your discussion of punitive and your intro in your brief, in which you suggest that the State Farm case, the U.S. Supreme Court invited legislative action. That's a generous reading of that case. You say Ohio's General Assembly accepted the challenge posed by the U.S. Supreme Court. They simply told the Utah Supreme Court that the damages in the State Farm case, the punitives, went too far. And my reading of Justice Kennedy's opinion was to say in no uncertain terms that one size doesn't fit all, that depending on the amount of compensatory, depending on, as he pointed out in that case, it was emotional damage, not physical damage to the parties. And even though the conduct of State Farm was reprehensible, and I think if you, as Justice Ginsburg points out, Kennedy left out a few of the salient facts, including the fact that State Farm had been hit with another big punitive damage case in another state and claim not to even know about that.
Your Honor, if I may, let me give you a quote from the most recent authority just cited by opposing counsel, the Philip Morris versus Williams case. Therein, the U.S. Supreme Court said, unless states insist on proper standards to cabin the discretion of juries, their punitive damage systems may well deprive defendants of the fair notice of the severity of a sanction a state can impose, unless a state imposes proper standards that cabins a jury's discretion. I consider that more than an invitation, an instruction. Who imposes those proper standards? It is the legislature, and some members of this court believe public policy questions like that are better answered by the legislature, who's better equipped. It can be the court.
Hasn't this court done that in the punitive damage cases that we look?
In Darden versus Anthem, Your Honor, this court acknowledged that punitive damages are not a right by any plaintiff for any plaintiff. And in fact, the courts can unilaterally
divert. And
in the
Figge case, we took away some of the punitives, saying that's too much.
Well, and right.
On a case-by-case basis.
This court also recognized that some states have passed statutes that mandate that a certain percentage of punitive damage awards be taken away and diverted to nonprofits or this, that, and the other. So it can be an across-the-board fair allocation of rights and burdens when you balance what you need to balance in a consistent and fair justice system. And that is what the legislature has done in this case in all three of the statutes we have at issue. And in the non-economic damages, for example, they have taken the one element of damages, non-economic damages, which have been expanded over the years to include such things as hedonic damages, which they have found that juries have the least standards to go by, which they have found have a tendency, especially in cases where there are not catastrophic injuries, for juries to award them to punish instead of to compensate. So they have looked at a very small area of damages and decided that this is an area
the chief
where it's
pointed out, and the facts of this case may be one of those. Some people may have very small specials as a result of something happening, and a lifetime of problems, and doesn't that one size fits all, doesn't that really fly in the face of due process? And add to that, in terms of the jury question, not telling the jury you know, you're the fact finder, but we're not going to tell you what the limitations are, what's going to happen to your verdict.
Well, as to the latter question first, I think there are certainly examples in our legislation, including the Joint and Several Tortfeasor Act, where the judge has to deduct the settlements after the jury's come back that the jury doesn't know about. So there are certainly examples of where the jury makes the fact findings, going back to the right of jury trial, but the legal consequences of those fact findings are determined by the common law, either as developed by the courts or by the legislature. And is it going to be a violation of due process? That is a question this court must decide, and I understand that. But what I would urge this court is to recognize is that it has to be a meaningful remedy, not a specific remedy in any given case. The due process only requires a meaningful remedy. Is $250,000 up to $350,000 in the kind of case that you are indicating, and no cap at all, if because of these serious injuries, the case should have been put in the catastrophic. Is that a meaningful remedy? We would suggest that it is. We would suggest that this court's looking at and constitutional jurisprudence, which itself evolves over time, which is another issue. Justice O'Donnell, you asked about the Sheward case, and I think it's agreed that the Sheward case is really, as Justice Stratton said, a limited situation. But it also is a matter of there is no straitjacket of judicial jurisprudence that this court has put into.
Do we need to overrule Sheward if we, I'm over here.
Sorry.
I know it's confusing. Do we need to overrule Sheward if we would agree with your position?
Absolutely not. Sheward, Your Honor, was limited to separation of powers and a determination that the legislature engaged in constitutional adjudication and invaded the power of the court to do so. All of the rest of the decision, what they consider to be examples of constitutional adjudication, not an analysis of the terms and the provisions of each statute at issue, much less an analysis of the statute that's before this court, which has different provisions, which has considered the very concerns that this court has expressed in many of those cases, and changed the statute accordingly.
One of the questions that Judge Katz certified to us concerned the equal protection, the division between the catastrophic and the non-catastrophic. I don't think you addressed that really in terms of the categories.
Yes, Your Honor. For the equal protection analysis, the first thing you must determine is whether or not there's a fundamental right, and this is economic legislation. No fundamental right is at issue when you define catastrophic versus non-catastrophic. So in that situation, you see any rational relationship between the legislative purpose that would justify the treatment of catastrophic and non-catastrophic. Again, certainly there are conceivable facts that would justify, and as the legislature explains, a finding that in non-catastrophic injuries, juries have a more tendency to have fewer standards to apply because there's usually not the same kind of pain and suffering, and are more likely to misuse non-economic damages to punish in cases where punitive damages are not allowed. And in fact, that is a strategy that we often see employed in these cases, not to even seek punitive damages with the high standard of proof that they require, but to imply, you know, look what they did to her, how embarrassing, how humiliating it was, to get the largest non-economic damage award in a case where there has been no or little physical injury. And this court has repeatedly held that the type of damages may depend on things such as physical injury when you don't mental language with or without physical injury. It wasn't until Schultz versus Barberton Glass that this court got rid of the physical injury requirement for receiving mental language damages at all. What this court can do, the legislature can do. Just as there's no question that the legislature would be able to pass a law now recognizing negligent genetic counseling and a limited damage rule that excludes consequential damages for that.
Ms. Keyes-Walker, before, I know your light's on, but I have a general question on the stare decisis issue. There was a litany of cases that was identified by counsel that would have to be overruled if we were to find in your favor. Could you just briefly comment on that?
I wish I could remember the entire litany. The one that stands out in my mind is of course, Morris versus Savoy in the Zoppo case. Neither one of those has to be overruled. Both involve different statutes with different provisions. This is a statute that has provisions that have been changed to adapt to the specific constitutional violations found in those cases. In Morris versus Savoy, as I indicated, it was a finding of a lack of fit between the legislative purpose and the damage cap in that case, which was different, to meet that fit. In Zoppo, that provision of that punitive damage statute required the judge on an individual case-by-case basis to decide punitive damages. That is exactly the evil that the right to jury trial was passed to prevent.
And finally, my final question. This is a challenge to the statute in general. Can it ever be deemed to be constitutional? I mean, it's a different standard than as applied, which I think opposing counsel would like to us to examine. In other words, we must look at the constitutionality overall on these issues that have been raised, but there may be cases down the road where the statute as applied would, in fact, be a due process violation or an equal protection violation. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And in those cases, for those as-applied cases, this court will have a full record of facts before it to determine how the courts are interpreting these statutes and applying them to individual cases. And that is exactly what the development of common law based on legislation of the court is supposed to do. And that is why, in conclusion, I would ask this court to recognize that neither the Constitution nor this court's constitutional jurisprudence is in a straitjacket. The legislature has listened to this court. It has revised statutes. It has held hearings. It has found facts. And we ask this court to uphold it.
Thank you, Ms. Keyes-Walker. Ms. Avery, you've used your time, but Mr. Peck is going to take rebuttal. Okay. You have 30 seconds unless you get a justice to ask you some questions. Then you'll have more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Tell us what's on your mind.
let me go back to your... That was a question. Let me go back to your original question about what inviolate means under the right to trial by jury. And this court has always employed, just as the U.S. Supreme Court has, a historical test. What the jury's prerogatives were under the common law when the jury trial right was adopted are the prerogatives that the Constitution preserves against invasion or interference from both judges and the legislature. What is clear is that determining damages are that prerogative. Unless you consent to a remitter, you have a right to a new jury trial. That is the instance, as the court said in Dimmock, the U.S. Supreme Court said in Dimmock, that you have the right, as in the first instance, to a jury determination of your compensatory damages.
Although, counsel, in some cases, the jury verdict may be added to by the court. I mean, triple damages, for example.
Which of course, but that's, of course, in a statutory cause of action, and so therefore it's not a common law cause of action to which the inviolate trial by jury right applies in this fashion. In fact, in the...
Doesn't that violate defendant's rights? You have a defendant who also has his inviolate right to a trial by jury. The legislature determines that jury verdict can be tripled. Why wouldn't the defendant have an equal argument that that's an invasion of their right to a jury determination of damages?
They would if it is a common law cause of action that is codified by the legislature, and therefore their right to trial by jury would be violated unless they consent. Where it is not a common law cause of action, but a statutory cause of action, therefore exists by the grace of the legislature can define damages. This is a critical distinction. This court recognized that distinction in the Chester Park case in 1929, where as paragraph 1 of the syllabus states that the power to reduce a verdict of a jury or to render a judgment for a lesser amount without the consent of the party in whose favor the verdict was rendered is wrong. And so, therefore, this is what the inviolate right to trial by jury means. We are preserving the common law as it was understood in 1851 when this provision was added to the Constitution. And in 1851, there can be no doubt, the jury determined both economic and non-economic damages. And that is what the legislature has invaded by here.
Does that argument include then any judicial expansion of that common law right is not subject to the right to trial by jury, so that in a proper case, this court literally could peel off decades of development and expansion and go back to when it was put in the Constitution?
Again, this court has employed a historical test. So it's what the Constitution is preserving the prerogatives of the jury under the common law as it existed in 1851. For the legislature to change that, they would either have to basically go into a time machine and return to pre-1851 to change the law, or a constitutional amendment. Now, this court also applied that principle in Zappo. And that's why, under this court's precedence, the jury also determines punitive damages. Now, in 2001, in the Cooper versus Leatherman case, the Supreme Court decided to split the baby. They decided that punitive damages had evolved and no longer served the compensatory purposes. So while they said the Seventh Amendment right to trial by jury means that you can't do this to compensatory damages because they serve that compensatory purpose, and they were specifically talking of non-economic damages, they said you could do this reexamination and apply due process, and without offering a new right to a jury trial, you could reduce the punitive damages. But as Justice Pfeiffer stated, even in the most recent case, Philip Morris versus Williams, which I argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, they did not invite the legislatures to come in. When they said that they are going to insist that states cabin this authority of the jury on punitive damages, they were talking about a jury instruction. There was a new mandatory jury instruction that says that you are allowed to take harm to others into account to determine reprehensibility, reprehensibility still being the most important indicator of the validity of the size of a punitive damage award, but you may not punish for harm to others. And what this translates to as a practical matter is that you simply can't take the punitive damages, or the compensatory damages, and multiply it by the number of presumed victims within the state. So what the court said is you can't engage in multiplication there, and the court has also said there is no mathematical bright line. You don't engage in multiplication to determine punitive damages in any individual case. The purpose of punitive damages is to express the state's condemnation of the conduct, to punish and to deter, and what the jury is asked to do there is decide how much is necessary for punishment and deterrence. When that is grossly excessive, then it violates substantive due process, and that's what the court has said in this line of cases. Now, here what we have is
the
jury.
The justice has given you about 3 minutes more than time that you were
entitled. All right, well, I will simply
so
then ask that you declare the two caps in SB 80 unconstitutional. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.